we hug, we can make a sign, and we can talk. She's an amazing teacher, and she and John Seed are contributors to this book, and I just want to read a small quote from here. We ask for the presence of the spirit of Gaia to be with us here, to reveal to us all that we need to see, for our own highest good and for the highest good of all. We call upon the spirit of evolution, the miraculous force that inspires rocks and dust to weave themselves into biology. You have stood for us for millions and billions of years. Please do not forsake us now. Empower us and awaken us, pure and dazzling creativity. You that can turn scales into feathers, seawater to blood, caterpillars to butterflies, metamorphose also our species. Awaken in us the powers that we need to survive the present crisis and evolve into more eons of our solar journey. We ask for the presence of the spirit of Gaia.
Amen.
But just helps to just give a little dedication to, you know, why we're here. There's some heavy stuff going on, and we're here to figure out what we can do about it, how we can handle that at being empowered people at this time. So that's pretty much why I think we're assembled here. And on that note.
So I actually was, you hit a little nerve there, which is, it's the chrysalis. You know, here we are as a species, you know, going into our little cocoon, and what are we going to emerge as? And one thing I am acutely aware of is that the DNA, you know, people used to think that the DNA had this sort of solid, constant rate of change over time. But it turns out that when the pressure's on, the DNA mutates a whole lot faster in response to that change. So if you're a flower blooming and you expect that insect to show up, well, the climate's changed, now the insect doesn't come until later. Well, then you can't set your seed that the bird's going to eat until later. Well, if you don't start figuring out how to bloom earlier or do something different to attract a different bug, you're not going to make it. So the pressure's on all of us, species-wise, on the planet, on our DNA. And our DNA is the same. It's the same as it's been since the dawn of time. This is just the form that it's taking. All the things on the planet that we're sharing time and space with right now, we all have got here at the same time. So now, what are we going to metamorphose into? It's really kind of an exciting thing. Okay, so how many people here have taken a permaculture design course? 1, 2, 3. How many people had an introduction to permaculture, have a clue what permaculture is? Okay, anybody have never heard of it, don't know anything at all? Okay. Okay, that's what I want to know. Okay.
Jenny, could we do introductions just
because
I think some people don't in the room are not known yet.
Okay,
else.
That's great. So I'm Jenny Pell, I live in Fort Townsend. Yes. Yeah, so where you're from. And
Sharon Tuva. Can I add one more thing? Say something that you really enjoy about being alive back with your name in town.
Well, my baby. Nothing else is in my head. So.
What do we really enjoy? Moving.
My name is Dana, and I live here in Port Townsend, and I love smelling flowers.
My name is Jeremy, and I live in Olympia. And I really love all of my senses related to other beings through other senses.
I'm Rebecca, and I've kind of wandered around the Northwest Coast, but right now I'm living outside of Bellingham. I really like to just play.
I'm Barbara, and I live in Fort Townsend, and what I really like now is I've been living by myself since January.
My name is Keith. I live on Maristone, across the way. I think it's that way. And I like to listen to the animals singing.
My name is Eric, and I live up on Dundee Hill in Port Townsend here. And I like pulling myself away from the garden to do something even better, which is to show up and do something sort of like this.
My name is Jill, and I live on the other side of the Fort Worden Hill. And I love really big, really mossy trees.
My name is Connie, and I live here, and I really love socializing.
My name is Melinda, and I live in Orchard, and I love art.
My name is Nala. I live on Maros, Rhode Island. Keith. And I really love my relationship with my cat. I find it miraculous that two different species can interact like that. I mean, I'm literally blown away every day.
Know what you mean.
Okay, so this is a smallish group that if something in a slide really catches your attention and you want to comment on it, or you have a question about something we're going to say, please speak up. I have a lot of slides to cover in a short amount of time because Nala wants to do some body movement afterwards. So some of them I'll just whip through, and other ones we can sit and sort of stay with for a little while. Okay? So you have to
choose.
Okay, so permaculture, the definition of permaculture is the two words permanent agriculture put together, which we hope over time will become a permanent culture. And what does that mean? How do we have a permanent culture? How do we have all our needs taken care of locally in a way that all the skills involved in the systems that support that are embedded and embodied in our community? How do we attain that? How do we get there? If we used to have that in any town or village pre-industrial, everybody had to do that. You had to have all those skills, you had to have all those systems in place. We don't have it anymore. So permaculture is trying to find our way back to that, but we're a modern society now, so how do we do that at the same time? So it's a design methodology. A lot of people want permaculture to be about food, but it's not. It's about everything. It's a holistic approach to design. So I have it written here, a design methodology that intentionally creates sustainable human landscapes based on clear ethics and principles. So we intentionally set out to design things. And it's not about this element or that element. It's about the relationship between the elements. How do we create that relationship so that it has synergy, so that it has an energy of its own as well? So I'm just going to jump right into slides, so please So there's five basic areas that we look at. There's energy, obviously solar energy, wind energy, any of the clean energies that we want to come up. There's water systems. Okay, this is the water catchment system in Hawaii at a friend's farm. There's natural building your own. A lot of people these days don't know how to build anything. They are completely disempowered in the building arena. The codes are restrictive. They're kind of difficult to maneuver. You're immersive bureaucrats. And here you are with a proven building methodology that is highly insulating, absolutely beautiful, breathes, is fun, is sculptable. And my favorite struggle story is the building inspector, the head of the building department in Seattle, when they initially tried to have a permanent straw bale, was quoted in the paper as saying, "Not now, not ever, over my dead body, will there be a straw bale house in the town." There are several, there are quite a few now. But it took.
No, I haven't seen him dead yet.
But he rolled over early, you know. It's like, so Being a power to build.
Why was he against that?
He thought it was an inferior design because he's an old school kind of person. Like, this is interesting about like, when you're getting into some of these, what we call alternative, which of course are really our generally traditional design approaches, you get up against really entrenched folks. One of the biggest challenges in design right now is gray water. People who are trained in old school gray water think it is the most dangerous pathogen on the planet, and so they won't let you have a system. Okay? I think a septic system underneath your house with all your poop sitting there is kind of, you know, that doesn't work for me either. So, you know, it's like, how do you get people to, you know, come from a new approach? And generally what happens is the old school people eventually retire and, you know, we need to have some of us young folks entering these bureaucratic type of jobs as well. So this is also in the natural building, but it's food and energy and waste all wrapped up in one. So this is what we call stacking functions. We try to put a whole bunch of stuff in one system that supports relative location, the synergy of it. So here's a passive solar design, fire of benevolent queens would be dictated by law, where the sun comes in and heats the house. It's an attached solar greenhouse. Well, as it gets hot in the summer, the plants grow up and shade it out so it doesn't get too hot. So we're creating food right outside our house with this beautiful design. We get shade, we get food, we get energy, we get beauty, we get all these different systems just in one main element, which is the house, supporting all these different functions stacked on top of each other. And let's see. And also the waste of food. So if you had, you know, if you're doing a humidor or a composting toilet, you would just be feeding that waste right into the system. And the gray water, we're also running through tubes through here, so your waste is going right into the system as well. Okay. Nala really wants to talk about mulch. So here we have the worm who really loves his environment. So does anybody here have a really active, functioning, worm-filled compost system?
In my dreams.
Yeah. Those worms are pretty amazing, right? You know, the vermiculture. And most people don't compost. Most people throw that into a landfill. Like, people don't get it still. It wastes people's time. And when we can create these systems that have highly mulched systems, you're letting your waste decompose and turn into food. You're creating a space for the roots to grow. You're having something that will stay incredibly hydrated. A well-mulched garden can use 80% less water if it's designed right. How many people have seen a tree and people put this mulch that goes this direction? Okay, guess what? The water needs to go this way. Okay, so when you're designing, people put the mulch like this because that's what everybody sees. That's how you're supposed to do it. That's not how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to put it so that the water gathers. There's a couple of folks down in the New Mexico area who took a permaculture design course, and they started to harvest water off their neighbor's sprinkler. So the neighbor's sprinkler would cut off, and they designed something on the street. They took a piece of the herb out, let the water drip down, and they put a tile down into their garden. So all the water came down into their garden, and within a year, their place was just this huge permaculture edible landscape, and all they had next door was brown grass. They had the water all the time. So anytime anybody did anything, they took these water harvesting techniques. And there's a really great book. I mentioned my library, and sometimes we work together. There's a great book that has all different ways that you can catch and trap water, and how we've been taught to do it the opposite way. So you have to really push away all this, like the curb again, takes it down to a drain where that could be going into your house or the basins that are used.
And I have an analogy for that. You know, part of what we're going to be doing here this weekend is seeing how these principles apply in your own body in the arts. So we'll be playing different, for example, a theater meeting where you're asked to improvise a story or improvise some kind of movement. And a lot of times what happens is, you know, we're taught to waste things that are truly authentic because they might look weird, you know, they might get you landed in a mental institution in some areas, you know, if you really move the way your body really wants to move, you know, and so these things are considered waste. But as we learn in permaculture, waste is usually a profound resource. So if we can start to, when we play games like, or create works of theater, we're actually practicing the principles of permaculture in our own bodies, and we start to get it. You know? So we'll talk a lot more about that.
So permaculture is based on...
What was the book that you were saying about?
It's called Dry Lands Water Harvesting.
Brad Lancaster.
Brad Lancaster. And it's a series of three books. The first one is really great. It's really straightforward, really easy to read, and it's got excellent graphics. So you just look at the picture and go,
"Keep moving, moving."
So it's a really good book. And if you want to get into more details, he has all the mathematical stuff, like this amount of water will water this amount of the garden over this much time, this much roof catchment will have this many cubic feet of water. He's really, it's a good book. It's a couple years old.
And he's really nice.
So permaculture is based on three main ethics, and anytime we question what we're doing, we try to just, you know, go back to the ethics. It's really simple. Care for the earth. Can you, in your everyday decisions, care for the earth? Can you do that? I can't do it. I drive my car, fly my planes, you know, but I can buy fair trade. I can not use plastic. I can... You know, I can. What can you do? What are you doing every day that's not caring for the earth? Can you stop doing that? And to me, that coffee is a great example. If you're not buying fair trade coffee, you're supporting slave labor. Period. End of discussion. If you're not buying organic bananas, you're supporting people in other countries being exposed to massive amounts of chemicals and becoming sterile and dying off. Most of them are indigenous. Okay, so this is your direct contribution if you're not doing the other thing. So can you? Can you just care for the earth? Can you do that? Can you find a way to that ethic as a baseline, everybody? And that's it right there. Care for people is the second ethic. What happens if you don't care for people by design? They're going to take care of themselves. If you have a family to feed and the communities are set up to care for you, you're going to go do whatever you need to do to feed your family. Period. End of story. So we have to, when we create our design, we have to design for people. We don't want to shuffle our old people off to corporal nursing homes where they sit and don't give us their accumulated knowledge over time. You know, we don't want to do that. We don't want young people who don't know how to grow tomatoes because we don't let them have access to old people. So here we are. What's our responsibility? What's our, you know, how do we do? How do we care for people? How do we design for care? And then to distribute the surplus, what we also call fair shares. This is from our project in Nicaragua. These are all grafted mango trees. These are kids who I've known are a lot bigger than this. And they're taking trees home. But surplus isn't necessarily a tree from your nursery. It's not like, it doesn't just translate into plants and things like that. A lot of surplus is knowledge. That's my main surplus right at the moment, is teaching. I don't have a lot of things to give away, but I have a lot of knowledge to impart. So what is your surplus? Is your property, have a good water catchment basement, is you, what is your personal surplus? How do you then distribute that out so that it becomes useful to the community? So those are your ethics, always going back to that. And then there's a whole series of principles, so it's like 10 or 12 or 15, and they keep getting bigger. As more people join the movement, they realize that there's more basic principles, and I'm gonna go over just a few of them as we go through this. Okay, but this is another distributed surplus. Check out this farmer's market. This is in Fresno.
Wow.
Okay, look at that. Okay, so here we have distributing the surplus, supporting organic farmers, community meeting spaces. This is also stacking functions. This is a community stacking function by design. I want an arbor like that. I mean, that is cool. So here's a permanent farmer's market location, which we don't have. And with the arbor, with beautiful shade, cover, gathering space, many, many things happening. There's habitat, niche, birds, insects, there's all kinds of things going on here, as well as just that sort of beauty of the space that draws you in. Okay, I'm going to show this to the farmer's market. I just found this slide.
It's right in the middle.
So, yeah, it's pretty neat, huh? So that's another distributed surplus slide. Okay, so one of the main principles of permaculture is observe. Observe, 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 observe. Sit in nature and observe. And I picked this picture because Jane Goodall, for me, represents the person who I don't know anybody on the planet who does perspective work. And she went out as a young woman and sat there and observed these creatures in their habitat. And that's why we still have any of zero, starting at yourself. If you aren't a whole, healthy, paying attention person, how can you design a whole, healthy, paying attention system? It's very hard to do. You'll do it poorly unless you can yourself be in a grounded place. And I look at this picture and I just, it's very moving to me that they are having a relationship with Nala's anchor cat. I mean, these guys have this deep relationship over time and they're just contemplating life. But observe, observe, observe. You can have a relationship with anything you want. You can have a relationship with a flower. You can go sit it every day and watch that flower open. You'll know more about that flower than anybody else will ever know. You can watch the bee come and pollinate it, and you'll learn just by sitting there and watching it happen. And in the tropics, when I worked down there, a lot of indigenous folks, you'll see them sitting around staring off into the, you know, void. And people will say, oh, they're lazy, oh, there's something else, that they'll judge them. But guess what? They know exactly how many monkeys have babies. They know which trees have leaves cutter ants in them. They know when the next storm is coming. They know so much because they just sit and observe their environment all the time. It's not something that we're taught to do. And I would encourage everyone here to find time to sit and be in an observant space about themselves, about their community, about their garden. It doesn't matter what it is. It's a practice, learning how to be observant.
We're going to be doing that with each other.
Yeah.
So the correlation between observation in the movement world is what a lot of you might know as witnessing.
Yeah.
Very important for healing the psyche, and it's an exact analog with the which is pretty much the basic law of permaculture design is observe, observe, observe.
Observe.
You can't do anything without doing
You
can't do anything well.
We encourage people to spend a whole year on their land before they start to sign and build. What does the sun come up? Where does the moon set? How does the water flow? Where do the deer walk through? How does the wind go through the trees? Where's the energy line? There's an enormous amount of knowledge you can gain before you design. People in our culture are like, what should we have project done? And they don't know anything about the land. The land hasn't even spoken a word to them, and they already have designed.
So
they can design for the map from a map.
Some architect will go design it and never even visit the place, right?
So that's not a permaculture building, so to speak. So this, here's a man collecting seed from corn, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware of genetic engineering. I'm not going to go into it here. The way that you do that is you pick the best ears and you save those for seed. Okay, this is observation, this is knowledge, this is a grandfather, this is something you do with your kids, this is something you do with your grandkids, this is something that you learn through embodied experience. He just, in his body, in his members of his body, he knows exactly how to do that. He can pick the best corn out of the whole bunch and sit there and save a seed. Okay? There's a terminator gene now in corn that allows you, that doesn't allow the seed to reproduce anymore, so it becomes sterile. So this is a real dangerous thing.
Are folks aware of this in this room?
There's so not enough time to go into genetic engineering, but they're genetically modifying the corn so that it can't reproduce. You can buy the seed every year so that you're beholden to the seed company. And it's most important. But it's really important to study that. Okay, so this is starting small, and it gets vacuum functions. How many plants are going out of the little tiny garden? And why isn't there any dirt showing? Most people's garden have a plant and a bunch of dirt. But when you have dirt, that's where the weeds are going to grow, right? So we try to fill in all that space, and then in a really tiny garden, we can have a huge amount of abundance. This is also another permaculture principle, is that start small and then obtain a yield. Because when you get the yield, you're like, oh, I grew as a plant, and you feel really excited, and you're really proud of yourself. If you start on 20 acres, and you don't know what you're doing, this is the great story of, I had to use Roundup because there were so many weeds. Well, you don't need to be doing 20 acres. You start in a 4x4 garden space. Here we have dock, nasturtiums, oxalis tuberosa, fava beans, and chard, all just like crammed in this one space with no bare dirt somewhere, which means that the soil's not going to dry out either. So the sun's not going to hit it and dry it out. So we're using the plants to give us abundance. Some are perennial, some are annual. So some you have to plant every year, and some will just continue to grow year after year after year. So you have edible flowers, edible leaves, edible roots, edible tubers, edible beans. So like in a small area. So start small. Okay, creating niche. So if you can create niche so that you're attracting other species like frogs, that means you've got water and sun and a place where the frogs can live and dance and hang out. And so you want to have frogs in your system. Frogs are really important. You know, so one thing we can do in permaculture is we can put together the elements that will let those things create synergy together. So we can put in a pond, and we can have a tree, and we can put a birdhouse, and we can, you know, we can have a little rock waterfall going down, and then things will come in and colonize that we don't even necessarily know what they are. We can certainly have intentions for a butterfly garden and our hummingbird garden or something like that. But really, what we want to do is create niche to attract biodiverse species so that they can then add the synergy to our land. Okay, so frogs eat bad bugs that we don't want in our garden. That's a good thing for us. Okay. Also, frogs are really threatened now. So we want to have frog habitat. That's a good thing. Okay, here's another stacking function. This is a rooftop garden using a little hydroponic system where they just take this coconut husk and a little piece of mesh, shove the plants in, and look what you can have growing there. Okay, in just a really, really short amount of time. Okay. So stacking functions, growing food, urban landscapes. Again, I have plots, I'm just going to go really fast. Okay, this is an espalier fruit tree. Okay, some people call it horticulture. I don't.
Horticulture.
But so what is this doing? Stacking functions, food, privacy, windbreak, habitat. What else is it doing? Okay, so it's beautiful to look at. So here we have it in one, it's easy to reach, it's designed for easy to pick. So
saving space.
It saves space. So in one design concept, we've just stacked a whole bunch of really important functions. Okay. Privacy is really important. Windbreaks are really important. All those things are, you know, it's can be fodder for animals. There's all kinds of ways you can look at it. In a more permaculture intensive design, the understory would also have edible things or flowers or something, or some kind of insectary to attract bugs that we want. We could put mints or catnips or things like that that would repel bugs we don't want. So there's all kinds of designs we can do underneath that. Okay, kids in the garden. I think when people talk about intergenerational sharing, they think it's old people down to people my age. But it's not. This guy, he's 20 and he's talking to 5-year-olds. So you know, you always have knowledge you can pass on up and down the chain of age. Don't forget that. And kids love to be in the garden. This is a kitchen garden in Hawaii. They have aloe and yams and sweet potato and all kinds of things, as perennials and annuals growing in this garden. Okay, other things we want to attract to our garden is creating niche for lizards. Lizards are really important. They're predators in the food chain. Okay? But this is being in your body, being in your soma body. Are you a lounge lizard? How can I attract you into my sphere?
Do we have lizards here? I know we have salamanders, but I don't understand.
Are you up on Oregon Island? They do. What you want to do, if you want to attract these more predator species into your environment, which is critical for a healthy environment, these guys will eat rodents, they'll eat bad bugs, they eat, you know, when you see lizards and snakes in your environment, you're doing well. So you want to have like rocks that have space in between. They want to get hot and they want to hide. So that's how you can, that's how you can help to bring them in. But this in terms of like your when you're realizing yourself through your body movements this weekend, it's like, you know, who are you in the landscape, and what are you bringing to the table in terms of your skills and your interests and your dynamic energy? Okay.
Wow. Woo!
That mushroom can feed a lot of people. Okay. Fungi in the system is really important. Fungi is actually its own kingdom. A lot of people don't realize that they think it's a subset of plants, but it's not. It's its own entire kingdom. And I wrote something down about fungi because it's just my favorite part of the whole
thing.
Pardon?
He looks so uncomfortable. And I love that he's wearing a Doors t-shirt, one thing that I love about that they're merging string theory and
grill, and you know, it's like, you know, it's very meat-like in its texture. I'm not a big mushroom eater myself, but I really love the Mushroom Kingdom. But the picture that I really want to look at is this one. This is my single mat blown up 500 times. So, in one cubic foot of mycelial mat, there's a mile of mycelial threads. Did I get that right, or is it an inch? Or like, is it this, like, I think it's in an inch, like in this much topsoil. It's in the first 4 inches of topsoil is where all the mycelial mat is. Some of them live 5 years, some of them have lived longer than a millennia. And some of them are 30,000 and 40,000 acres big. And 95% of plants on the planet, trees and plants, etc., have a symbiotic relationship with mycelium. Whether it's an ecto on the outside of the root or an endo relationship, where those actually penetrates into the root. And the mycelial mat actually, its job is to keep the system in balance and healthy. So it'll share chemicals across plants and across species of trees and plants, etc. So the mycelium will travel around and it'll recognize that this particular plant group is suffering from a certain chemical deficiency, and it'll draw those sugars from the roots of another plant and feed it to the other one. So that's part of his job.
Is there any connection between that and like probiotics?
Yes.
In the intestines or something like that?
Yeah, because yeasts are fungi. And yeasts are essential for your healthy gut flora.
Yeast.
And there's a lot said about candida, but only if it's overgrown. We don't even know how many kinds of yeasts are in your gut or my gut. So, yes, they're
I never connected those two.
So yeah, so this mycelial mat, it's the more mycelium you can have in your system, the more moisture it can contain, the healthier your plants will be, the more nutritious the plants will be that are growing, et cetera, et cetera. And what some people will do is they'll go to a really healthy forest and dig up a bucket and put it into their compost, and then that mycelium will be inoculated into your garden. That's one way to do it. So, or you can buy a mycelium from Postamus down in Fronti Perfecti. And I have this whole great thing written about fungi, and I didn't bring it. So anyway, the fungi, this net, what's so fascinating about this net is we often talk about a tapestry of life and how we weave these tapestries of life. And you know, as long as the threads are overlapping, you know, if one of the threads is broken, we still have the fabric generally is intact. But that's a bit two-dimensional for me. When we go into the mycelial mat, it's multi-dimensional. So if any one thread breaks, it doesn't matter at all because the net is pulsed from all different directions. Does that make sense? So you know, even in a tapestry, we can patch it, but you don't really need to patch a mycelial mat. And then, to me, this is kind of like the way the internet works. You know, it's like so many connections going on at once. Okay, so this is really quickly, I'm just going to run through these slides. Skills that we really must have in our community. Grafting. Almost all the fruit you eat is from grafted trees. Apples, pears, plums, apricots, nectarines, peaches, pears, citrus, mangoes. They all come from grafts. And I don't have time to go into what grafting is, but if you don't know how to graft, you can't have this diversity of fruit in your system. So grafting is a really important skill. Cooking bread in a wood-fired oven. How to make bread. How to make bread from your own local yeasts. How to do sourdoughs. How to make breads. How to make cheese. We have a creamery in our town. It's so exciting. Okay, but these are people, by having these skills embodied in your local culture, we have a biodiverse, strong, interesting, character-filled culture. We don't have a bunch of accountants. Not if you're an accountant, I'd apologize. But it's not like we're not just in the service economy. We're in the economy. We're in community, and we're in service to each other by offering these
service of paper money.
Beekeeping. I'm a sugar eater, big time. Okay. So you know, I love my sweets. So the skills that we can talk about. Okay. Which takes us to storytelling. We realize that the word story comes from the stores that we create, the food that we harvest. While we're taking care of the bees. bees, and while we're harvesting and then growing our gardens, we're building our stores. We're making our stores. And when we put them into storage, we have stories to talk about. And when we sit down to eat those meals, we're tapping into our stores. And that's when we tell our stories. We sit down around the table and we eat our stores and we tell our stories. And the storekeeper is the root of the word for the restaurateur, for the restaurant. So when we go to a restaurant and we sit at the table with our friends and we tell stories, we're eating the stores that are the stories. Well, if you don't participate in creating stores, what's your story? Well, if you're eating non-food food, what's Michael Pollan call it?
Food-like substances.
Edible food-like substances? Okay, if you're eating that and watching television, watching somebody else's story, you're not participating in the story. You're not helping to create a new cosmology. You're not creating the new thing we're morphing into. You're just sort of being stagnant and not being a story, creating stores.
And that's where the theater, the movement, all of those things come in. And, you know, storytelling wasn't like there was one person who is an expert, like we have expert actors or expert dancers, and there's only like a handful of them. It's everyone got together around the dinner table and told stories, everyone. And that's, you're restoring your body, you're restoring your culture, you're passing information on to the next generation. And that, I love that, that's where the word restaurant, restaurateur, you're restoring, you know. And as, we'll just talk about this more as the weekend goes, because I'm thinking, we'll go more into that. But here's a local artist and a local gal here, to the mural, the Kalapa, Kaska. She's creating stories. This is the story in action right here. You tell this story. This is a wriggle. This is the harvest. Look at them all. They're all sitting around eating, and they're kids, and they're like passed out in the sun. And this is, again, this is their story. These are their stories. Okay, it's about their local culture. It is their culture. Same with the wine harvest. Okay, while you're out there with the other women, you're gathering up the grapes, you're talking about your lives, creating your story. We need some new stories. We really need new stories. And that's just the power of story to me is just undeniable. I put this in here because during World War II, the government said, grow gardens. You can get, you can get, for food stamps, you can get starts and seeds. But they really wanted you to participate in a local food economy because we were stressed out for food nationally and we couldn't rely on imports. Well, how many people have noticed the cost of food skyrocketing? Okay, food riots around the world? It's not funny. People are starving to death all over the planet because of skyrocketing food prices as we convert corn into ethanol, et cetera, et cetera. So where's the leadership telling us to do this?
Go shopping.
Go shopping. Buy what? Last week in Jamaica, the Jamaican agriculture minister announced a multi-billion-dollar project to grow their own food because they can't afford importing food anymore. Kids in schools, 4-H projects, certain towns targeted, everybody getting free seeds and starts, education process. It's like, we cannot afford to import food, we're going to grow our own, we're going to do it as a national endeavor. Okay? That's leadership. That was for me.
You said that was last week in Jamaica?
Well, I wasn't okay, but
ongoing in Cuba.
Yeah. Okay. And here, look at this. Rustling on a pot-belly stove in the store, telling stories. Okay, this is a classic American photo. Here's Nala. Mulching. So this is a project we did with Public Works. Public Works hired me, and I got a lot of volunteers together, to close the loop on several waste streams, including cardboard and biosolids, and to plant an edible foodscape around the recycling station down in Havelock. And we put in fruit trees, and we put in nut trees, put in nut orchard in, and we put in a whole berry food hedge. And it was a really very successful project, and it was really fun to get hired and get paid well by Public Works to do an edible foodscape.
where people come to drop off the recyclables, and when it gets mature, people can just pick those foods and harvest those foods.
I also have to point out that hat is a recycled hat that I got at one of my good friend's stepfather's funeral. It was his hat. They were giving his stuff, and I thought, oh, I love that hat. And then I recently went to Hawaii, and I didn't want to take this tattered old hat back on the plane. It was part of the journey, and it got passed on to another person.
Thanks. Another mulch. Okay, so here we are planting these things. No one's going to tend these plants. Okay, they're out at the recycle station. They're not going to get watered. They're not going to get looked after. So they have layers and layers of mulch and sawdust, and so that they're going to retain all the water that goes in there, a deep root network. And then we actually inoculated each plant with mycelial spores. Okay, so. And I drove out there just recently. Everything looks great. It's just amazing how well it is. Okay, sitting on the table, telling good stories, eating good food, sharing community. Most people in America don't do this anymore. They don't do this. One person sits down at the table with their food. The other person's on a different diet. They go get their thing, microwave it, go watch television. Somebody else goes and plays video games. Nobody sits down together as a community anymore. This is one of the most radical act you can do in this country now, is to sit down and share food. And I hope that feels like an alien concept to most of you, that most people don't do that, but actually it's true. And it's very sad to me. Why not sit around and play some music afterwards? You know, these are the kinds of things, the traditions that we're losing.
And this is the stuff you remember. I mean, when I was younger, these are the beautiful
things. Yeah.
You don't remember playing video games?
Okay, you remember watching Bewitched? this is your precious moments, you know, and you think that songs are stories too, and we have to remember that passing that lore on or creating new lore, creating new stories, song is critical for this as well. Okay, this is a little shift in gears here. Barren landscape monoculture. What it looks like. Not living, not growing there. Right? This is on Orcas Island. This picture 25 years ago looked like that. It was a barren potato field. And the Bullock brothers plugged up a wetlands and planted it intensely. And that's what you can have in one generation.
Is that really the same piece of land?
No, that's not the same piece of land. It was a potato field when they got there. Okay, so. Culture barren, nothing growing, to incredibly biodiverse landscape with food and habitat and forage and worms and insects and beavers, and it's on the Pacific Flyway, it's full of birds, and you can go in the canoe and you can go have recreation, and it's so here you have, transforming a landscape by design. Okay, putting the elements together to create synergy, which then gets filled in by nature. Okay. Monoculture cityscape in Russia.
Whoa, that's real.
That's a real photo of a Russian apartment building. Okay.
It is?
Vienna, Austria. There's somebody's cityscape design. Okay. Where would you rather live?
That's winter possible.
Yeah. Okay. So look at this. This is a biodiverse, intense, stack functions, fascinatingly interesting cityscape that you can create. Okay, you have a mind for design. Okay. What does it feel like to go to work in classic America? Versus getting together with your friends and telling stories and being in the sunshine. Okay. What do you want to do? At work? Okay, yeah. Right. In America, working. Versus these guys working. Okay. We used to have extensive hops fields all around this region right here.
Bellingham.
And we were famous for our hops. And these are the guys, when I always talk about this in my lectures, people move to Port Townsend because they like the rural character. And then it's so expensive that the characters move away.
Okay, so these are the kinds of characters that we still have in town, but we're being forced out. We're being gentrified out. It happens all over the place. But Fort Townsend has a mandate to keep folks like us around. So how do we find a way to live here and afford it and create right livelihoods?
They do.
The town? Yes, they do. And there's actually people coming. We're having a people from Lopez Island and Land Trust are talking about affordable green housing and how to do it, create it, have money and build it. And they're doing the boost to schools programs and they have the town needs. So here we go. So this is, you know, different cultural landscapes and how do we design for that? And this, I put this in because of the bee, because I'm also bee collective. So here your little bee goes out, he does his little bee, goes around, he goes to myself, and he goes back, he does a little bee dance, he goes back to the bee brain, and, you know, what are we as the scouts from the hive? How many people here like to travel and go out? Okay, so you go out and you meet new people and you learn about their systems and you see how they do their water catchment, or you see how they raise their kids, or you see how they cook that food, and you come back and then you make this amazing meal for people that they've never had before. So you're like the scout from the hive. You come back and you do a little bee dance, and everybody like learns from you about this cross-pollination that's going on all the time. So it is really important. I think, you know, I travel, that's my biggest vice. That's what my carbon footprint is made up of, is my travel. But I think it's so critical these days to have this cross-pollination going on, particularly from like-minded analog people around the globe. And you can learn so much and bring back to us. Okay, so this is tequila fermenting. Okay, so the fermentation process. So permaculture is also really getting to the fermentation, raw food. This now there's a whole raw food permaculture network. And you guys can talk about this more in the workshop, and I won't be here. But when you ferment food, it makes it more nutritious. Okay? And it makes it more available to digest, and it makes it last longer, and all kinds of things. So here you have the food fermenting. Here's a painting called Fermentation. Okay, so here you're coming from this more somatic place. You're coming from your inside of yourself, you as your own personal permaculture landscape. What's your interior landscape? What's going on in there? You have things that are boiling up and coming to the surface and need to come out. And in that process, are you becoming more informed and aware and nutritious and delicious and juicy? And, you know, so what is your personal fermentation? What's fermenting inside each of you?
It's like cultural fermentation.
Yeah, so here's what that might look like.
It's contemporary.
This is called walking meditation. You're like this empty vessel that's going out to receive you and to be in your landscape. And when you take these walks and you take a walk really slowly through your environment, you see things and you realize things and you notice things you've never ever seen or noticed before. And as I take that time to be in an observing place, but not necessarily of the outside landscape, but of your interior landscape. You know, how do you get comfortable with going into that interior meditation space? What is that thought process? What is going on in your body that lets you be reflective in a really healthy way? What does that feel like to you? Is there a baby in there?
Yeah.
What's fermenting in this person? What's coming out? What are you expressing? What are you growing in your personal garden? What is the sun that's coming and hitting your body? Like what do you need to express now? This is what you guys came to this workshop for, is to explore this playful zone zero. Who are you? What is your, what's going on inside of you? How can you express that? How can you become in a joyful, healthy interior landscape that lets you, you know, bring that out to the world as well?
Imagine you walk down the street and you just saw people doing that, you know, more often. I mean, I think it would be really cool, but I think people don't do that kind of thing for fear of judgment or, you know, handcuffs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So like, it would probably be a lot healthier, I think, if we were able to express more of what's just naturally coming out. You would have less of a need for an insane asylum with padded walls, and then that's the only place you're allowed to express, you know, like wild and crazy. Maybe
cooperation is not part of our culture either. Like, we're taught to be capitalist and to, you know, is it that great advertising campaign of potato chips? Get your own bag. You know, get your own, have your own, that's all for you. You know, cooperation is key to our own culture. I mean, absolutely key, cooperating, sharing. And small movement, vote for small food farms, local food. Eating is an agricultural act.
You know, and you see, we need to publish people.
Yeah.
Last year around.
And it's
not very, that's not old.
No, this is just, like, Barry has, there's a whole, Earth Island Institute is doing this wonderful thing about local food and the slow food movement, and, you know, it's, people are accused of slow food movement of being very elitist, and I understand why people say that, but you know what, it's not, it's entirely grassroots. Why? Because it's rich people eating truffles and having fancy bottles of wine and traveling to Italy to go to a slow food conference, you know?
Well, and it's rich people having the time to make food slowly to do that whole thing.
Exactly. And I think that slow food is the radical statement of, you know, radically rooted statement of making food an agricultural act. I would much rather spend a lot of time cooking and having a fabulous meal with my friends than watching television. Any day of the entire universe existence. So vote for local. And it's, what I like about this poster is it plays on that same image from the wartime, you know, Victory Gardens. And it's a patriotic act. It's a matriotic act. Like, it's your matriotic duty. You know, it's like there's a point where you can kind of jump in there and do these things.
Your matriotic duty.
Yeah, it is. And I think that the patriarchs need to step up and feel that power. And, you know, considering that women really still do create almost all the meals at homes. And, you know, we're sitting down on Sunday and we're having dinner and you're going to sit at the table. And I was like, there's a point where, to me, where you have to insist. And
go ahead. We didn't plan this out, but I just happened to have written this down in my journal, that Wendell Berry quote. So he says, eaters must understand that eating takes place inescapably in the world, and that it is inescapably an agricultural act. That how we eat determines how the world is used. And that quote was in Carter King Sullivan's book about a year of eating local.
Yep.
And I, in that passage, I started crying because she points out that farmers in our culture are like a joke. Either they're invisible or they're a joke. They're rednecks, they're hillbillies, you know. There's, you know, divide and conquer is alive and well when it comes to the rural-urban divide here. And I realized, I was just weeping because I realized how I've said those words myself.
That's a good
lot of respect for farmers.
When, in the 50s, you were that dirt farmer pick, farmers were considered low-class, ignorant people. And you didn't want to be a farmer. You didn't want to get off the farm. You wanted to go to the city and become more educated or whatever. And I think this is an important cultural shift now, that we love and value our farmers as really smart, capable, filled with skilled people. And how do we change that? How did that story change for us? You know, now the farmer is a megalopolis, gigantic, huge piece of property with gigantic equipment, getting subsidies from the government to grow monocultures and dangerous crops. This is, you know, we as this, you know, sort of emerging culture, we have a responsibility to change the definition of farmer, you know, to something that is a loved and valued and cherished member of our community that we need. And we need that badly. So,
yes.
And this picture I chose because she's both eating in the garden and looks like she's meditating and having a rapturous experience all at the same time. So this is, again, that sort of inner landscape of, oh my God, my body is loving this so much, and being in nature and having that feeling, fruits from the garden. And what does that feel for you? I want to do that, you know? I see that, and that's, I want to be in her shoes. And saving seed is absolutely critical. I mean, I've grown a garden for years, and very, very rarely get to the point of saving my seed. So getting to the point where you have an understanding of the full cycle of the garden. And in the tropics, this is a guanabana, it's a delicious fruit. It doesn't travel, so you have to eat it there. And we in the tropics move genetic material across borders all the time. We go and seek out the most delicious, fabulous plants, and we gather their seedlings and cutting, and we take them to other places to grow them. And sometimes we'll be sitting in a group of people, and we meet some people, we'll all look at each other and go, that's so good! And we'll all save the seed and dry it and take it and plant it to the next place. And so at that moment of like, sometimes you eat something that's not really that tasty, but wow, and it's the really good one, you want to make sure that you pass that seed along with genetics. And of course, humans have been doing this for millennia. Most of us have forgotten that that's how everything that we eat exists now, is because so many thousands of years ago, once this is yummy. And this is a forging of samples. Here you have, again, as we're in this sort of cathartic place of radical, scary change on the planet, we're forging a new future, we're forging a new self, forging new ideas and new concepts. And here's another sort of you as your fiery being, getting out there and banging it out. What are you creating? And it feels fiery. It is scary. And it's also really exciting. This is my last slide. So this is divining. He's water witching, or he's divining for water. And the divine means inspired by God. God breathed life into you, so you know how to do that. Gaia channeled you to find water. You're the conduit for that energy. You can find water, you can find ley lines, you can find all kinds of things. The earth is there through this divining.
Is it the same thing as dowsing?
Dowsing, divining, same word. Yeah.
Or witching.
Water, witching, divining, dowsing, it's all the same thing. And so you have this ability, if you can be in your body enough, to be a channel for that. This is the kind of thing you can do. You can find water underground.
Has anyone ever seen this being done?
I have once.
The town utility guys who are in these sort of like uniforms driving trucks, they water witch down the street when there's a leak with their little divining rods. Okay. It's not like it's some weird esoteric skill that only witches do on the full moon. It's like it's a complete international way of finding water. But it is, what I understand is you get down into your real like lower chakra and you kind of you ground yourself and you walk the land, this very grounded feeling. You're not out here in the airy fairy place, you're here way down in the ground. And when you hit the dowsing spot, you cannot hold the stick up. It's like, okay? So it's an amazing experience, and there are people that teach dowsing if you're interested. But I chose this kind of skill that we need to observe. Yeah, and I chose this as my last slide because it's very evocative of skills we can lose, and it was divine for many, 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 many things, and now we're only divine for one or two things. Fault lines for like, a lot of people have an innate ability to understand energy on the land. So when I'm hired as a consultant to come to a design project, people will often say, I'm putting the house up there. Because they sense that that spot is a very powerful energy spot. But that's not where you should put your house. That's where you have your fire circle or your gathering space or your meditation spot or your, it's a place where you should recognize that it's a powerful spot. Because if you live there, you're going to be disturbed all the time. That's where you go to visit when you want to be in your power. And it's very hard to convince a client that that's not a good place to put your house. Because they know that it's a powerful spot. They want it. And so know your house should go up here where it's gentler and, it's more restive and you go there all the time, but don't live there. And so one of the words that allows us to wrap up and not too late. So building skills, remembering, what are your members of your body, your arms, and your legs, and your fingers, and your pieces, your members of your body? So how do you remember? You all know how to do all these things, or you wouldn't be alive right now. Your ancestors had to survive droughts and famines and floods and all kinds of things so that this DNA continued to this spot. So somewhere inside your DNA, this knowledge exists. And so how do you remember that? How do you put that back into your body knowledge
by doing it, by practicing it, by living it, by eating it, by sharing it, by coming from the inside out as well as the outside into this place of remembering with your DNA. And having a baby right now, like my son and I were studying, we do sign language. He's 14 months old. He can sign more than 50 signs. Okay? And he understands maybe another 100 signs. Okay? So by doing that, there's like this proto-language. Before you speak, you can sign, you can communicate. He's opened up these neural pathways. The concept is there. He'll actually ask me, like, what's the sign for that? Like, he's already guessed the concept fully.
He saw how big he is.
The neural pathways are opened. Okay? If you don't study that when you're a baby, it's much harder to come learn it later. You still can, but it's much harder because the neural pathways haven't just been opened. It's not like it's a road that you're already traveling on. It's like a path in the woods that you gotta hack out with learning a second language. So this kind of education for a lot of people, it's remedial, which also has the roots in medicine. It's the same root, the same word. So we're doing remedial human life education. What does it mean to live sustainably in your local community and not pollute it and not damage it and not damage your neighbors and not hurt anybody else and actually not just be sustainable? Sustainable doesn't work for me. You have to be adding more abundance. Getting to sustainability to me is like, okay, so now that we're at the pendulum is like sort of swung back to center. You have to swing it back over. We've lost so many species recently. We used to eat hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kinds of foods, now we eat 10 or 20. Most people in this country don't eat more than 20 things, period. So how do we get to this additive permaculture where we're growing abundance all the time? And that's sort of one of the precepts of permaculture, is that yeah, it is a lot of work up front, but once you get your perennial landscape in and your mulch in and your system developed and your water catchment and your passive solar hot water, once you're sitting your compost, once you've got it in, it's a whole lot more abundance for a whole lot less work. Whereas if you have a garden that's got a lot of very dirt and weeding it all the time and getting a very poor yield. So it's sort of getting out of that mindset and into an abundant mindset. So this is a fallacy, I think, of the sustainability movement, is that a lot of people equate sustainability with having to give stuff up. Well, I'm going to try to live more sustainably, so I'm not going to drive my car as much. I'm not. They have this whole list of things I'm not going to. But instead, what you want to do is say, well, I'm going to live sustainably, and I'm going to get to eat really great local food, and I'm going to have meals with my friends, and I'm going to sit around playing music, and I'm going to have all these things that sustainability is going to provide for me. That's a really different attitude than I'm not going to. No, it's I'm going to get to. That's the shift we need to make.
I've learned recently that the subconscious or unconscious doesn't recognize negatives.
Oh, that's nice.
So interesting. Yes.
Say again?
I'm not sure if it's the subconscious or if it's the unconscious, but it doesn't recognize negatives. So when you say, I'm gonna get to it, it totally shifts.